And that's a very important question for all of us to ask. How does this thing play out in real life? What does it look like when somebody is transformed fundamentally by their encounter with a God, the sovereign God, who interacts with their life and in their life in a very specific way? And I think that's really what you have when you see, especially when you see Paul saying, follow me as I follow Christ. He's saying, look at my life and what it does with regard to the gospel, and imitate that, and you will begin to understand its parameters. So that's really what I see. When we see God interacting in these lives, we recognize some of the things that he wants to accomplish in our own life, right? So who did we look at last week? Last 2 weeks, actually. Whose life did we examine? Abraham, right? And what specifically encounter did we see where it was pretty miraculous in terms of its transformation? Of his character. The promise of the Son, exactly. That fundamentally changed who he was and what he was about, right? And what was the heart of that covenant that God made with him? What was the heart of that promise? And especially if you bring into light some of the New Testament theology in this as well. Through him, all nations would be blessed. And that blessing was what? Land, wealth, righteousness. The righteousness of Christ. Through the person of Abraham, all the world would receive the blessing of Christ, right? And through his descendants. So what I want to do is I want to keep that in mind, because the Abrahamic covenant, that covenant that God made with Abraham, was really a pinnacle of the narrative, of the story of the Old Testament, right? Wouldn't we argue that that's the case? That the idea that God promised to Abraham that he would have a son that would have a son that would continue down until we have a redeemer. That's a heart of that theology or of that argument. So one of the things that I want to do is, as we look at these encounters, I want to continually tie them back to that promise. We're going to look at another individual today that's found in the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter, and we're going to go to chapter 30 and 31. But this guy in particular isn't necessarily one that you would say, oh yeah, this is absolutely the kind of guy that you would expect God to interact with. It's Jacob. So what do we know of Jacob? Tell me a little bit about what you know of the guy named Jacob in Scripture. Do what? He's your kind of guy? That's what you know from Scripture? Okay, you like Jacob. Good. What else? He was chosen by God. In what way? I'm sorry? From the womb. Absolutely, yeah. Very good. What else do we know about Jacob? Just on a practical level, historically, what do we know about him? Right. He becomes Israel. His name is changed to Israel, right? How many kids does he have? A lot. How many sons did he have? 12. And one daughter. But the thing is, I'm sorry, what? That we know of, that's true. That are listed. Thank you. So the fact is, he has his 12 sons, and what do the 12 sons become? The fathers of the 12 tribes of Israel, right? Yeah, we're all aware of that. What else do you know about this guy? He's a liar. Ooh, you're mean. Well done, well done. You mean he or Jacob? He's a what? A liar, a thief, a schemer, a deceiver. What'd you say? Oh, yes. Aha. Well, that's too bad. What else do we know about this guy? He was repentant as well, absolutely. Where do you see that? He was running, yeah, when he was running, God met him, right? And so you see his repentance. Right. He saw the vision. Yep. So he had many encounters with God, correct? I'm sorry, what? He did wrestle with God as well, which is an interesting one. We're going to get to that. Probably not this week, let's be honest. What else? I'm sorry? He limped. Ah, that's true. He was a limper. He became gimpy. Yep. Anything else about this guy? Yes, ma'am. Yeah, he saw the ladder, Jacob's ladder, right? Angels going and coming from heaven to earth. He stole his brother's birthright. We know a lot about this guy. Anything else? Anything that's really just pressing on your spirit that you have to share about him? Sorry, what? He did get a new name. Isn't that interesting how often names change when they encounter God? We talked about that last time as well with Abram becoming Abraham. God changes his name as a reflection of that encounter. One of the things, yes. The first recorded incident of genetic engineering, very good, and we're going to talk about that for sure today. All right, anything else? He was very much swindled by his father-in-law. All right, that's a good transition into where we're headed this morning. Genesis 32, before he tells it all. Stop it! Genesis 32, 28, he said, and who's the he in Genesis 32? Let me read what he said and then you can guess. Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. God himself interacted with him face to face and transformed fundamentally who he was. So we've identified that we know a lot about him, but most of what we know prior to the event that we're going to examine this week and next is that he was pretty seedy. He was pretty deceptive. He was very crafty in his approach at getting for himself what he wanted. The story that we're going to start is I'm going to take you to Genesis chapter number 30. And verse number 25, and we're going to go through quite a bit of this section here. But when we encounter Jacob in this section of the story, he's already run from home. And why? What necessitated his fleeing from home? His brother Esau wants him dead. His brother is absolutely convinced that this is the guy that deserves to be dead. Is it true? Did he have a right to kill Jacob? I know that's a loaded question because no one ever has the right to take another life, but what was there cause for his anger? Yes, absolutely there was. Jacob had manipulated and had stolen and had deceived and had used his brother to get his own needs met. And as a result, Esau, in his hot-headedness, decided, that's it. He's dead. And so Jacob had to run. And where did Jacob run to? Does anybody recall? His uncle. Who is this uncle? Uncle Laban, right? What is the connection between Laban and Jacob, other than the fact that he's uncle? It's his mother's... What? Is it his mother's brother? Right, because it's his uncle. I was all of a sudden going to say, wait, am I getting this wrong? Yeah, it's his mother's brother. Why would he run to his mother's brother, do you suppose? He was already a mommy's boy, right? Let's be honest. He was pretty connected to his mother, Rebecca. And because of that, you know, he doesn't have a lot of the family members on his father's side that are really pleased with him either. So he decides that he's going to go back to the foreign country where Abimelech had brought back for Isaac his mother. And so he runs back there. He says, at least I'll be safe here. And he shows up there and he begins to work for Uncle Laban, right? But that situation with Uncle Laban was not developing well. So what happens in that narrative? What happens in that story? Why does he begin to work for Uncle Laban? He saw a girl and he's like, woo, I want to work for this lady. And so he barters with his uncle here and comes to a conclusion about how he can marry her. And then, of course, we understand what happens. He gets Leah instead, so then he has to work another 7 years for Rachel's hand in marriage. So he's here for 14 years working with this guy, Laban. What was Laban's primary occupation? He was a shepherd. He was a herdsman, right? He had property and he had animals. And when Jacob showed up, did they have a lot of that? Was there a lot of, you know, was the company a fairly large and substantial one? According to the passage that we're going to read, it actually wasn't. When Jacob first got there, there wasn't a whole lot going for Uncle Laban. He was just sort of mucking it through. But this company, as soon as Jacob showed up, the company became very successful very quickly. And in chapter number 30, we jump into this narrative after he has completed his 14-year, actually he's probably past that by even a little bit, years of working for the hands of Leah and of Rachel. And in chapter number 30, now, when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, she became jealous of her sister. And actually, let's go to verse number 25. I mean, that is kind of part of the story, but I don't want us to take too long. So let's go all the way to 25. So Rachel ends up finally having a son, Joseph. And now it came about when Rachel had born Joseph that Jacob said to Laban, send me away that I may go to my own place and to my own country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you and let me depart. For you yourself know my service which I have rendered to you. But Laban said to him, If now it pleases you, stay with me. And I have divined that the Lord has blessed you, has blessed me on your account. And he continued, name me your wages and I will give it to you. So basically what we have when this story starts out here is that Jacob recognizes that this is a dead-end situation that he's in. He's gone for 14 years working for Laban. Now, has Laban treated him well during that period of time? Has Laban done well by Jacob? No, probably not. I mean, what's the clearest illustration of the fact that Laban is probably taking advantage of Jacob? Well, that's later. We know that's coming. But there's something already in the narrative that we've identified. How many wives does he have? How many wives did he want to have? One. He's already been tricked once in a pretty substantial way by this guy. Laban has manipulated the situation to his advantage and allowed him to get 14 years of work out of this guy who's been very efficient and effective. And at the end of this tenure with him, Jacob finally says, look, I'm done. I need to get out. I need to look to the things of my own family. I need to look to their needs. I'm ready to go. I don't want to stay here anymore. Let me take my wives and my children. And at this point, you know, Laban's grandchildren, let me take them and go my way in peace. I'm finished. He's submitting his, you know, tendering his resignation. Here's my 2 weeks. I appreciate the time we've had together, but I'm out. All right. So Laban, what is Laban's response? When he brings this argument to him, when he says, I'm ready to go, I'd like to leave. Laban says, if now it pleases you, stay with me. I have divined that the Lord has blessed me on your account. What was Laban's answer to Jacob's desire to leave? Stay. I want you to stay. You guys have, you know, bosses that are like this, right? You especially have bosses that are like this. Who, when you submit your resignation after a period of time, when you've tried, you've done right by the boss, but it's just, at this point, it's not working out. And you go to him and say, unfortunately, I just need to go. The situation here is not what I expected. My wages are not what I'd hoped. Our relationship is tenuous at best. I need to leave. And the boss says, hey, what can I do? He makes a counter offer. What can I do to keep you? I have divined that God is blessing me through you. What is divining that God is blessing? He had gone to God in prayer and said, dear God, would you like me to keep Jacob? Would you like me to keep him around, Lord? If that's your will, I'll do it. If not, Lord, I'll send him in peace. Is that what he had done? No. What does divining mean? Yeah, by magic or demons. He had a communion or a communication with demonic forces, and it is determined from that he should keep Jacob there. And why? What's the heart of his argument? I'm getting rich off you. Why would I let you go? You're wealthy to me. I have talked to the demons, and they've told me that I should keep you because you make me wealthy. Sounds like a good guy to work for, right? I mean, maybe some of you think you work for this guy. Like, my boss absolutely talks to demons. There's no question. But at this point, he recognizes Jacob's, is it clear that Jacob's intentions here are probably well-founded? Is his concern probably legit? I would say yeah, based on Laban's response. I want you to notice one thing in particular, what's absent here. What do you notice that's absent from his appeal? Something blatantly absent from this desire. Who is Laban? He's his boss and his uncle and his father-in-law and grandfather to his children, and one who should care for Jacob. I mean, he's negotiating with his son-in-law based on a conversation that he had with demons so that he can have a bigger pile of money. That's who this guy is. Pretty astounding when you think about it. Pretty remarkable when you consider exactly what we're looking at in this passage. This is not a good guy. Definitely not a good guy. So Jacob comes to him and he begins to tell him or express to him what his desires are. And Laban says, I'll counteroffer. What can I offer you? What can I give you? And he said, name me your wages and I will give it. But he himself, and this is Jacob. Hey, Jacob answered. So he says, here's a counteroffer. Blank sheet of paper, friend. You write your wage down, it's yours. You make your terms. You want a bigger house? Fantastic. Want a car? You want an expense account? So you let me know. We'll do it. We'll make it happen. I need to keep you. Jacob responds to him and says, you yourself know how I have served you and how your cattle have fared with me. For you have little before I came, and it has increased to a multitude, and the Lord has blessed you wherever I turned. But now, when shall I provide for my own household also? This is a pretty shrewd argument that that our good friend the deceiver here is making. And I don't think he's being deceptive either at this point. But he's being shrewd. He says, okay, let's talk turkey at this point. Let's recognize what I've done. When I got here, you were poor. Now, 14 years later, you are wealthy. And it's directly as a result of my interaction with the company. So at this point, I have a question for you, Uncle Laban. When do I get to start earning enough for my own family? Is that a fair question to ask? Yeah, it's absolutely a fair question to ask. Is that an important question to ask? Very important question. I don't think that's a problem. And I think we can actually learn a little, some of us who are in situations where we also find this same problem. There's nothing wrong with saying, I need to make enough to provide for my family. That's not a bad thing. Some people, two commentaries I read, read that as this deceptive, deceitful, slimy Jacob-esque kind of thing. I don't really see it that way. I think there was a pretty legitimate concern that he had. I need to make enough for my family. I've got to start considering. I have at least 12 sons and a daughter. I have your two daughters that I'm caring for. Your two daughters that I'm caring for. You know, if they're skinny, it's because of you. I mean, I need to take care of my family here at this point. And so he asks him to give him the opportunity to care for his own family. So he said, what shall I give you? So at this point, it's still wide open. Laban says, okay, fine. Name the terms of your contract. What do you want? And Jacob said, you shall not give me anything. If you will do this one thing for me, I will again pasture and keep your flock. Let me pass through your entire flock today, removing from there every speckled and spotted sheep and every black one from among the lambs and the spotted and speckled from among the goats. And such shall be my wages. So my honesty will answer for me later when you come concerning my wages. Stop right there for just a second. This was a very smart move on his part, right? He says, okay, and it's in one sense it's a very smart move, but in another sense it's not a very smart move. Let me tell you why it's smart in the first place. He says, look, I recognize that this is going to be a potential problem. Why did he recognize that this might become a problem? Past experience had told him so. He recognized that Laban is not the most honest of characters. And if I say, let's just divide it evenly, I trust your word, I recognize you're an honest man, I will let you know what my hand has increased, and I will let you know what your work has increased as well. No. Let's make a plan here. Let's do this. How about I take all the spotted, the speckled, all of these other sheep and goats, so that it's clear which one belongs to who? This would have sounded like a fantastic argument to Laban. Why? Why would this have been a very good idea? And in fact, Laban says so. He says, hey, great, let's do this. Why? You talked about genetic engineering earlier. Why is this important? Right? Right, absolutely. They were. And in many instances, it would seem that a lot of what he was picking were those that were genetically weak, those that were not the best option, were not considered the highest, you know, to fetch the highest price at market. He was saying, I'll take the bad stuff, you take the good stuff. I heard one guy use the comparison of, let's just say you're working at a Chevy dealership as a car salesman, let's just say, hypothetically. And let's just say that at this dealership, your boss is taking advantage of you at every turn. And you finally say, that's it, I'm gone. Enough, I'm out. And the boss says, all right, well, what do you need? And you say, okay, here's the plan. How about you get the profit on every Chevy that's sold here, and I get the profit on every Ford that comes through? The boss is like, well, fantastic. I mean, what are the chances? We're a Chevy dealership. What are the chances that a Ford is actually going to make you wealthy? And from that point forward, all that they ever have that comes through is Fords, you know? That's kind of the same sort of a situation. This is the negotiation that he's doing with Laban. He's coming to this idea to help establish who belongs to what. And so he makes this plan. So my honesty shall answer for me later when you come concerning my wages. He fully expects him to come concerning his wages. He's planning ahead. He says, look, I know the discussion's going to come. I know and recognize at some point in the future, you're going to come expecting to take advantage of the situation. Now, how would David be so well versed in this deception? Not David. How would Jacob be so well diverse? How would he be so well versed in this deception? He knows exactly what he would do. He's like, I would do the same thing. I recognize in my own self that if I were you, I would probably try to take advantage of you. And so he divines this idea to come, or he doesn't divine it, because no, he didn't go to demons. He comes up with this idea where he will establish the parameters of the argument. And so he does this plan. And Laban said, good, let it be according to your word. Fantastic, I'll sign in the dotted line, I'll double sign. Oh, this is perfect for him. So he removed on that day the striped and spotted male goats and all the speckled and spotted female goats and everyone with white in it and all the black ones among the sheep and gave them into the care of his sons. And he put a distance of 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob. And Jacob fled, and Jacob fed the rest of Laban's flock. Now this is a pretty astounding thing as well. So what does Laban do as a result of this iron proof, this ironclad plan that Jacob came up with to establish and distinguish between the flocks? What did Laban do at that point? I'm sorry, what? I didn't hear you. Yeah, he got on board, sort of, but he also, I would say, manipulated the situation pretty substantially. Because what was the plan? The plan was, I'll take care of your flocks. And he says, okay, good. Since you, I'm sure you'll be busy with my flocks, and I don't want you to be distracted by your side business. So I'm going to take all of these and I'm going to give them to my sons. My question is this. What are the chances that his sons are going to take good care of Jacob's flock? They're hirelings, right? They're ones that they're not going to be like looking out for his interests. And he also says, I don't want you to be distracted by your other work either. So you care for my flock only, and I will let my sons take the flock and take care of your needs over here. So he's already introducing these caveats into the mixture. He's throwing in all this deception himself, Laban is. Another thing, he takes him 3 days' journey. Why would that be important? If you look at exactly who took what 3 days away, it would be very difficult for that group to actually have a lot of babies. Because of what Jacob kept and because of what he took, they wouldn't be able to expand as much. He took them far enough away where they couldn't come together, and there wouldn't be like, you know, the mingling and, well, this one came out spotted and then these two are black. It wouldn't happen. So he has come up with two very sneaky ways of diminishing the possibility of returns for Jacob. Very significant. And at this point, he does that because he wants Jacob to stay. And I want you to recognize something significant about Laban here. I've heard it said, some people love money and use people. And you see this clearly with Laban. Some people love money and use people. We're supposed to love people and use money. But a lot of people in our world very much approach money, and this is kind of a teaching on money to a certain degree as well, if you think about it. They approach their relationship to those that they hire and the money that they have, where they are so enraptured with their wealth that they will use people to get it. And at this point, they're not just using any old person. You're using your son-in-law. You're using your daughters. You're using your grandchildren. You are taking advantage of the situation to your advantage so that you can get what you want out of life. Laban was an astounding example of a wicked, evil guy. And it's funny because I've seen some commentaries try to say that he was honorable. I disagree entirely. From everything that I can see, he was the master of deception, which I think is interesting, especially in light of Jacob's history. He was a deceiver, and he was sent to the master of deception to see the end of his current path, to recognize himself in another, and to see what comes of that type of attitude. So that's where I think this unfortunate situation begins. The deceiver was deceived by the master deceiver, who later then accuses the deceiver of deceiving him. It's astounding how much of this goes on, where the master deceiver and the deceiver, it's a battle of wits. It's a matching of my ability to deceive and to come out ahead. And it's like this chess game that's played between these two guys. And it's really interesting how that works out practically. Jacob had not yet come to the place where he could trust God to accomplish his word without some backup system, which included Jacob's manipulation and deception. And what we're going to read next is that he actually takes advantage of this. So what was the promise that had been given to Jacob through Abraham? What is the promise, the Abrahamic covenant that is made to this nation? That you will prosper, that you will be blessed, that your family will be healthy, that you will have much wealth and promise, and that through you other nations will also become blessed. And you recognize in all three of the patriarchs, in all three of those cases, what do you recognize? That they struggle to make this, they struggle to see this happening. In their own estimation, it looks like there's no hope. I mean, I'm stuck. working for a deceptive character who is taking advantage of me and is making it harder for you, God, to keep your promise. It's making it harder for you to keep your promise. So Jacob takes advantage of the situation, and that's what we're going to read next. And he uses what I would call some manipulation, and I'm not saying it's wrong necessarily, but let me read it and then you can establish for yourself what he does. So he removes these, Laban removes them and puts a distance of 3 days. Then Jacob took fresh rods of poplar and almond and plane trees and peeled white stripes in them, exposing the white which was in the rods. And he set the rods with the peeled in front of the flocks in the gutters, even in the watering troughs where the flocks came to drink. And they mated when they came to drink. So the flocks mated by the rods, and the flocks brought forth stripes speckled and spotted. And Jacob separated the lambs and made the flocks face toward the stripes and all the black in the flock of Laban. And he put his own herds apart and did not put them with Laban's flock. Moreover, whenever the stronger of the flock were mating, Jacob would place the rods inside of the flock in the gutter so that they might mate by the rods. But when the flock was feeble, he did not put them in, so the feebler were Laban's and the stronger were Jacob's. So the man became exceedingly prosperous and had large flocks and female and male servants and camels and donkeys. This is a very interesting section here. Jacob looks at his situation. He says, I made a plan, fully expecting that that plan would develop into my wealth. But Laban has tricked me out of that initial plan by taking my flock, moving it away, and not allowing me to care for it. So then Jacob deceives him back. So you have a triple deception. He says, okay, fine. You're going to do that. This is what I'll do. And he begins to manipulate the situation to his advantage. He manipulates the flocks of Laban so that they begin to have the spotted and speckled goats and sheep. And he takes those, and does he send them away to the sons to care for? No, he takes those and he separates out another flock. He says, you can think that you're keeping my flock scrawny and unhealthy over there. I don't even care, because I have my own secret flock back here that's growing and prosperous. And he manipulates the situation with Laban's flock so that at any point, the stronger ones would be the ones that would be producing, and Laban's became weaker. And he became exceedingly wealthy as a result of this. What do you notice dramatically missing from this narrative? In terms of the increase, what do you notice? Usually when we see somebody gaining wealth and influence and notoriety, especially when we're talking of a patriarch, what's usually attached to it? I'm sorry, what? The relationship with God. God prospered, right? We don't see that. He became wealthy is what we see. So I would not say necessarily, now God was not, I'm not saying that God wasn't necessarily using Jacob's natural inclination to be sneaky here, but I think at this point Jacob is still using his own intellect, his own know-how to build his wealth. For the sake of what he, in his mind, I can see him spiritualizing the whole thing and saying, hey, I'm supposed to be God's anointed. I'm supposed to be God's blessed. What we notice is a dramatic turn shortly in terms of how he perceives the blessing that he has. But up to this point, we have a conflict building. We have a conflict brewing at this point, right? This immediately, when I was studying this the last few months, and especially this last week, I couldn't help but think of the theme for Bonanza. This sort of feels like an episode of Bonanza, doesn't it? I mean, there's a fracas that's coming here because he's got a secret company on the side and he's taking care of those, but he's supposedly also caring for these sheep. Laban's far enough away that he can't be aware of all the manipulation that's happening, but he recognizes his ledger is starting to look a little light, and suddenly he shows up at market and he says, wow, whose sheep are these? Wait, they're spotted. Where did those come? Sons, were these your... Oh, no, wait. Wait, he has another flock. Ah! That sneaker, that deceiver, oh, and he's beginning to establish in his mind that this is not going in his direction. So these two deceivers are this battle of wits, and they're trying to match their animal husbandry to each other to see who becomes the better of the two. All right, so that's where we have him at this point. And then starting in chapter number 31, things change. Now Jacob heard the words of Laban's son, saying, Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what belonged to our father's, and made it all this wealth. What was the attitude of the sons? What was their opinion of what was going on? I'm sorry, what? Thief! He's stealing! Why would the sons have that opinion? It's their inheritance, for one thing. He's not taking anything of Laban's, is he? Not technically. Not according to the letter of the law, he's not. I would argue that he might, if he knows how to make his flock stronger, he could probably do the same for Laban if he chose to. He's not technically using all of his resources, but he's abiding by the letter of the contract. I mean, yeah, absolutely, I'm doing what I'm told here. Why would his sons have that answer or that response toward Jacob? I think it's a reflection of their father. Often, our children's response is a reflection of us. They probably are hearing a lot of the same stuff from dad. Dad's getting mad, dad's getting angry. dad recognizes this, and they recognize it as well. And in fact, they go and tell Laban so. They're like, look, you're exactly right. Just what you suspected. Remember when you said that it feels like he has others? Well, man, it's so true. We were down at the watering trough the other day, and you should have seen his flocks, man. Dad, those were fantastic. Those should have been ours. But they were spotted and speckled. I mean, I tried rubbing one just to see if maybe he had painted it, and it wasn't. Ugh, that guy's stealing our wealth. That guy's stealing our prosperity. He's stealing our future. I hate that guy. And they're deciding that they're being taken advantage of. They're reflecting their father's love for money. And Jacob saw the attitude of Laban, and behold, it was not friendly toward him as formerly. I love that statement. It was not friendly toward him. Yeah, Jacob recognizes this is a losing situation. It is going from bad to worse. 6 years from that point that we made that agreement, and now look where we're at. This is not going better. This is going worse, and it's coming to a head. What was Jacob's tendency in a situation where things began to get a little uproarious, when he recognized a conflict coming? What is Jacob's response? Run. Run! Take off. Let's get out of here. Let's bail. At this point, the gig's up. The con's been done. Let's get out before somebody catches us. And so he makes this, he comes to this conclusion that he needs to run. Now, I want you to notice something pretty significant here, though. Something that's important to recognize in this, because you're beginning to see a shift in his attitude. You're beginning to see a shift in his mindset. And this is going to come full circle when we head into the middle of chapter 31 here, where you see this full transformation, like what you were talking, this repentant attitude. It is beginning to be developed by hardship here in Jacob. Now Jacob heard the words and he ran, and the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you. When was the last time that the Lord spoke to Jacob? Do we know? Bethel. When he encountered the Lord coming out. And that was back here. I had the verse up here and then I left it. Hold on. In chapter number 28, verse 15, and behold, I am with you, and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. That was the promise that God made to Jacob in Bethel. He said, listen, I'm with you. I will not abandon you. I will not forsake you. I will not leave you until you come back. Do not be afraid. Was Jacob afraid? No. Why not? Because he had his mind and his craftiness and his ability to genetically alter herds. In his own estimation, he had it taken care of. But suddenly things have come full turn, and he's coming to the end of this situation, and he's recognizing the conflict is building, and God comes to him and says, it's now. Time to go. So while I would argue that clearly Jacob was trying to manipulate the situation, who was at the heart of the situation? It was still God. Even in the midst of it, it was still God. God was using Jacob's natural tendency to deceit, in my estimation, to continue to fulfill the promise that he had, which is an astounding thing. This is why God can say the hands of kings and the hearts of kings are in the hands of God. The hearts of kings are in my hand. I can move them wherever I need. And yeah, they may be Pharaoh, and it may require me to substantially interact with them, but I will do what I will do. Do not be afraid. That is an important message for us. Do not be afraid. The thing is, God has promised he'll stay with us. He will never leave or forsake us. And yet we feel that we have to be crafty and cunning and come up with our own way to make God's promises true. That's not the case. God is sovereign. He will take care of us. He's promised it. So God comes and he says, it's time for you to go. Return to the land of your fathers and your relatives, and I will be with you. So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to his flock in the field. Jacob sends and calls Rachel and Leah to his flock in the field. This is a very uncomfortable situation. You guys recognize, those of you that are either in a relationship or are currently married, recognize the fact, and even those of you that maybe aren't, also know this to be true from other experience. It's very difficult to convince a lady of things. It's much more difficult to convince two ladies of things, which is why I would really strongly recommend against polygamy. Actually, there's a bigger reason than that. But the fact is, at this point, you've got two ladies. How connected are they to Laban? Pretty connected. I mean, after all, let's be honest, they're the daughters. All right? And up to this point, you've not seen any interaction with their relationship with Laban. In a moment, you'll see it. But for now, he calls them to the field. He doesn't want to make this little powwow obvious. He doesn't even want to do it in their tent because the trees have ears, you know? We're going to stand out in the middle of the field, and we're going to put ourselves in the center of these bleeding sheep, and let's discuss what the next move is. And Jacob says to his wives, He says, look, I need to talk to you guys about the situation here. I need to have an honest conversation about your dad. Awkward. And he says, I'm going to take you and I'm going to have this conversation. And so he calls them out into the middle of the field. And he said to them, I see your father's attitude, that it is not friendly toward me as formerly, but the God of my fathers has been with me. You know that I have served your father with all my strength. Yet your father has cheated me and changed my wages 10 times. However, God did not allow him to hurt me. Now, doesn't this go against what I just suggested about his attitude in this whole interaction with the lambs? He's attributing it to God. I would say that at this point, and especially, and I know it's hard to believe me, but stick with me. When we get through the middle of this narrative in chapter 31, which will not be this week, rest assured, what we will discover is that there is more going on here. He's beginning to have the trappings of relationship with God. He knows the right words to say. He says, look, God took care of me. How many times have you met somebody like that? You know, they show up in their beautiful vehicle, gold-plated rims and all this stuff, roll the window down, and, hey, what's up? Yo, hey, how's it going? Yeah. You know, multi-billionaire, and they're like, hey, you know, I understand you love God. Yeah, yeah. God's really cared for me. Smiles and his gold tooth glint. Ding! You know, there's a lot of people that can say the right words and imply that they trust God and that it's God that's giving them that increase. But the fact is, a lot of times we recognize that's not always the case. Just watch the televangelists, right? I mean, those guys don't watch them unless you really want to shoot the TV. The thing is, you recognize that they're manipulating people. They're taking advantage of individuals and they're saying, oh, it's all God. God is blessing. When in reality, they're manipulating the books and they're taking advantage of it. They're extorting. They're doing all of these underhanded, seedy things but on the surface, oh yeah, it's all God. I'm not saying that he didn't have an attitude or recognition of the fact that God is caring for him, because God had just reminded him of the promise that he made in Bethel. So Jacob is like, oh, that's it. That's it. That's true. That's right. Okay. So let's talk about God here for a moment. And he begins to share with his wives that things have changed in terms of their relationship with their father. I don't know if you ladies have recognized, but your dad is not really happy with me these days. And I noticed you were mentioning that we didn't have a lot of loving relationships, and he doesn't invite us over to dinner anymore. And last Christmas was really icy, and yeah, things are getting a little hard with him. And in addition, God's still with us and he's still blessing. So I think a move needs to be made. You know that I have served your father with all my strength. Is that a true statement? I have served your father with all my strength. I would argue that it's probably not entirely true. He clearly does know how to develop, and he was doing things very specifically to allow the weaker of the flock to become Laban's. So all his strength, I think it's more a statement of I did exactly what was expected of me. Nothing more, nothing less. I did exactly what was expected of me. All right? Yet your father has cheated me and changed... Oh, wait. Did I jump ahead? No, the other way. Yet your father has cheated me and changed my wages 10 times. However, God did not allow him to hurt me. That is a pretty significant deal. He's changed the terms of the contract 10 times. And we recognize part of the changing of the terms of the contract here were, okay, never mind, we'll take the spotted and now you can have the black ones. And they swap and then it goes and he does it again and he's doing all this stuff to try to take back what he feels is his, and Laban is the master deceiver, and Jacob is trying to match wits with him. It's a bad situation. If he spoke thus, the speckled shall be your wages, then all the flock brought forth speckled, and he spoke thus, the striped shall be your wages, all the flock brought forth striped. Thus God has taken away your father's livestock and given them to me. God has taken away your father's livestock and given them to me. That's an interesting statement, and I think it's an important one. Because again, he's beginning to tie more into the fact that this is actually the doing of God. He still knows that he had a very big hand in it, but he's beginning to attribute it more to God. And it came about at the time when the flock were mating, that I lifted up my eyes and saw in a dream, and behold, the male goats which were mating were striped, speckled, and molted. And the angel said to me in the dream, Jacob, and I said, here am I. And he said, lift up now your eyes and see that all the male goats that are mating, which are striped, speckled, and molted, for I have, no, they're not molted, they're not birds. And I'm supposed to be a zoological teacher. For I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. I'm the God of Bethel. I am the God of Bethel. What is that? Now, this is Jacob's relationship here. This is he relating this event. It's not recorded in Scripture. He's saying, this is what happened. We have to take his word for it. He said, this is what happened. I had a dream. And in that dream, God said something very specific. I am the God of Bethel. What was it, Bethel? Sorry, what? Yeah, that was where God established this commitment to him. He says, look, I'm part of this. I'm part of this relationship.
Later, when God said, I'm God of Jacob,
Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Yeah. And what did we recognize as one of the signs of a maturing believer? Is that they begin to recognize and know God, not by some spectacular event at the moment, by what he has done in the past. And by recognizing that he is working in my history to bring about his purposes. That is a sign of maturity. That is a sign of maturing. And at this point, God is drawing Jacob into that relationship where he's saying, look, I know I haven't spoken to you in a while, but I am still that same God and I'm unchanging. And I am still working in your life to develop you in this process. So he's telling his wives this. And this is an important thing as well. He's sharing this information with his wives to help them to understand the situation. So he's using a lot of his relationship with God in this. I'm the God of Bethel where you anointed a pillar and you have made a vow to me. Now arise and leave this land and return to the land of your birth. Okay, so the situation is dire. The situation is uncomfortable. And at this point, the conversation has to happen. But at this point, also, something significant happens in the minds and hearts of Rachel and Leah. Rachel and Leah said to him, they finally speak up, right? They jump in. They can't hold their tongues any longer. They say to him, do we still have any portion or inheritance in our father's house? Are we not reckoned by him to be foreigners? For he has sold us and has also entirely consumed us our purchase price. Let me talk a little bit about what they're saying there, because this is an important thing. The ladies have a choice to make. What are they forced to choose? Father or their husband? Let me remind you of something very important here, just on the surface, and this is an aside. You are not a godly man if you force your daughters or sons to choose between you and the one that God has given to them, right? That's a pretty important thing to recognize. They are forced to make a choice at this point, and that is a reflection of the fact that Laban is not a godly man. His daughters have to choose to follow their husband, and at this point they do. And they begin to think it through, and they say, you know what? Are we even in his will? Are we going to get anything out of this man? Is there any hope for us to be part of this relationship? Because up to this point, all I've ever seen out of him is for himself, for himself, for himself, and what he wants. And in addition, one commentator said this, I'm not sure that I'll go here, but I'll at least throw it out. He's kind of poor now anyway. I mean, your husband's a little wealthier, so maybe that played into the discussion, I don't know. That was when they were trying to be mean to Rachel and Leah, but I'll give them the benefit of the doubt at this point, and they're saying, and in addition to the fact that I don't even know that we're in his will, they treat us like foreigners. Whenever I'm with him, he's angry with me because I represent the fact that he's losing money. He's losing assets because of my husband. And they become angry with me, and there's this distance that's drawing between us. And in addition to that, he's consumed the buying price. What is that talking about? He says, he sold us. Is that really what happened? Did he sell them? It was an arranged marriage. Was that a selling? That happens all the time. What was it? Well, but men worked for their wives as well, in other situations as well. And there was dowry in this culture where they provided for the individual in order to have their daughter. So why are they saying it's a selling thing? The answer is in what follows it. And he consumed the price. He consumed that on himself. The dowry, according to what you see in Scripture, that dowry was actually more intended for the daughter than it was for the father. He was supposed to hold on to that and invest that and keep that in case she loses her husband so that he could provide for her needs as her father. That was the heart of the dowry. And then if he died before her husband did, hopefully, where would that dowry end up? Back in her husband's hands, right? To care for his daughter. The situation was not one where you were supposed to get that and say, yeah, I sold my girl, wahoo, I get to go buy a boat. It wasn't at all how that worked out. That wasn't what it was made to do. That's not how it was intended to work. And yet that's how Laban approached it. He took what should have been a representation of his care, his watch care for his daughters and concern for their safety, and he blew it. He committed insurance fraud. You know, he just said, all right, fine, I'll take it. You know, I'll take advantage of it and I'll use it all. Social security fraud. Fair enough. Something, some type of fraud. And so they recognize they're beginning to see their father for who he is. They're beginning to catch a vision for who this guy really is, and they're being honest with each other and saying, you know what? I'm not seeing him for who I wish he was. I'm seeing him for who he is. And a lot of times that's a difficult place, especially for a wife to find themselves. My dad is a jerk. My dad is evil and wicked, and that's who he is. That is a hard place for them to be. That's an uncomfortable situation for them to find themselves. The true character of Laban is clearly seen from the fact that his daughters entirely sided with Jacob against their own father. They had nothing good to say about their father. They said, you know what? You're right. He is an evil man. Even though it was husband against father, they seemed to recognize Jacob's position was correct. We can't put too much behind their choice of words, but it is impossible not to see it as a testimony to Jacob's general integrity. I'm not going to say, oh, obviously he was a very good and honorable man, because this is their opinion and it's hard to know whether or not they saw everything. But the fact is, at least in general, they recognized Dad is trying to rip you off. It's obvious. And at this point, we recognize that. So they make this choice and they say, yes, I guess at this point we have to. Surely all the wealth which God has taken away from our fathers belongs to us and to our children. Now then, do whatever God has said to you. So they decide that they will agree and go along with Jacob at this point. Then Jacob arose and put his children and his wives on camels. And he drove away all his livestock and all his property which he had gathered, and his acquired livestock which he had gathered in Paddan Aram, and to go to the land of Canaan and his father Isaac. When Laban had gone to shear his flock, Rachel stole the household idols that were her father's. And Jacob deceived Laban and the Arminian by not telling him that he was fleeing. So that's an important verse, that last one. Jacob deceived Laban by not telling him he was fleeing. Jacob is not, he's not out of the woods. He's not this honorable ding kind of guy. He still has a lot of that deception going on. He still is using the situation to his advantage. He says, all right, ladies, since we've agreed that it's time to go, let's do this very strategically. I want to avoid conflict at all costs. I don't want to have to be in a fight. So what I will do is I will encourage them to, when they're shearing the flock, which is in just a few days here, when he's already 3 days distance away, most likely, and when he goes even further to shear the flock, so they have to gather them all together and give them this haircut, and then when that's completed, or while they're in that process, that's when we're leaving. Because everyone will be engaged. It's sort of like branding, right? Everybody's out there doing that, and we're kind of away from the situation, so we can get out of here without him noticing. And so Jacob does that. He goes ahead and takes off. And at that point, we recognize that he's still trying to use his own craftiness to accomplish God's purposes. But things come to a head, right? Verse number 22. When it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, so 3 days later, Laban finally hears. Then he took his kinsmen within him and pursued him a distance of 7 days' journey. And he overtook him in the hill country of Gilead. All right, so comes back to Laban that Jacob took off, that he left. And he says, oh, I knew this was going to happen. And so he finishes, it appears that he might even finish the shearing, because it takes him 7 days, even though it took 3 days to get to him. And then he was still 4 days out, so he probably waited another couple days to gather together all the family, like, and he got them all in this powwow, and he says, look, this guy's robbing us. He's taking our wealth and he's leaving. He's running with the money, with the family money. It's time to get him. And this is really where you hear the bonanza theme starting to come. They saddle up and they take off. Dun, 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 and they go chasing down after him. All right. And God told, and so he comes to the hill country of Gilead. God came to Laban, the Aramean, in the dream of the night and said to him, be careful that you do not speak to Jacob, either good or bad. Be careful that you do not speak to Jacob, either good or bad. Would that be an interesting conversation to have with God? And first off, there's something pretty significant here as well that I want to point out, and that is that God was talking to Laban. God was intervening on Jacob's behalf at this point. He's saying, you better not even say, not only do you not do anything to him, you don't even say anything to him. I don't want you to touch him, Laban. Very significant. And one of the things that we recognize is that this actually happens. Have you noticed that each of the three patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, all of them personally experienced God intervening against one of their enemies? God is miraculously interacting in their history to protect and provide for them. That is very significant. That is an important thing to understand. I suspect that when we get to heaven, we will be amazed at how many times God intervened and stood between us and a problem. And we didn't even know it. But God is sovereignly ordaining these events and these occurrences to most effectively display his glory in the life of Jacob. All right? So he comes to this guy. Now, what happened the last time that God showed up to somebody in Gilead near Bethel? Got saved, so to speak. He met Christ, he met God and understood who he was, Jacob. What happens when God meets with Laban? Nothing. Zero. Nada. Other than that, he gets a little afraid and he's not as anxious to put a bullet through his head, because he's a little worried that, wow, that God, I've never had a God come to me in the middle of the night before. That's astounding. And Laban caught up with Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country, and Laban with his kinsmen camped in the hill country of Gilead. All right, so they finally encounter each other at this point. And they see each other at a distance, and you can almost feel the tension, right? As the dust settles from all of this group of horses, they pitch their tent, and they think, Jacob recognizes there's no running at this point. I mean, I have all of my flocks, I have all of my family, I have all of this stuff that it's going to take. I mean, it's going to take him probably 40 days to get from where he was to back to Isaac, back to Canaan. Running is not an option anymore. All right, he's going to have to confront the situation. Then Laban said to Jacob, "What?" And so this is where you have the unbelievable accusation. Laban said to Jacob, "What have you done by deceiving me and carrying away my daughters like the captives of a sword?" This is a very funny thing, because what is Laban accusing him of? "You've deceived me." Yeah. Takes one to know one. I mean, at this point, it's obvious that Laban was very much part of this whole process of deception, but he's presenting himself as the wronged one. "Oh, you've deceived me, and you've taken my daughters and my grandchildren like captives of the sword." Is that what had occurred? What had happened? They were his own family, and what did they say? Well, in addition to the fact they were Jacob's family, what was his daughter's attitude? Did Jacob have to throw him over his shoulder, kicking and screaming? They're like, "Please, let's go. Thank you for finally recognizing. I hate that guy. Let's go." They're not the captives of the sword. He's trying to play this wronged grandfather. Oh, you took my daughters from me. I just wanted to kiss them. He says that later. He's being overly dramatic to try to present this really disjointed argument against the fact that Jacob shouldn't have left. So he's trying to imply that this is the happening. "Why did you flee secretly and deceive me and did not tell me that I might have sent you away with joy and with songs and with timbre and with lyre?" He says, "I would have made a feast for you." Right. So not only is he's calling him a lot of different things at this point. There's four essential arguments that he's making. He accuses him of deception. "You carry my daughters away like captives." He accuses him of foolishness. He's like, "Look, you're being foolish. You're being too hot-headed here. I would have had a party for you to let you go and sent you off in peace." Right. But then notice what else. The third is that he threatens Jacob. So right after he tells him he would have thrown him a party, all right, so he's like, I would have done that and did not allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters. "Now you have done foolishly. It is in my power to do you harm." So right after he says, "I would have kissed my grandchildren and I would have thrown you a party," man, I could kill you. I mean, obviously at this point, it's pretty obvious that Jacob probably made the right choice to leave when he did. He threatens him, and by threatening Jacob, he actually confirms the wisdom of his secret departure. I think Jacob made the right choice. And so Laban goes on to say that "I have the power to do you harm." And then finally, he accuses him of stealing his household gods. He kind of gets to the heart of the issue here next. I have the power to do you harm by God, but the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, "Be careful not to speak either good or bad to Jacob." I love that he tells Jacob that. He's like, "I could just, man, at this point, if I wanted to, me and all the family here, we could just take you. But your God told me I'm not allowed to. Now, you have indeed gone away because you longed greatly for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods?" That, to me, is one of the funniest things I've ever heard in Scripture. Why did you steal my gods? If your God can be stolen, you need to get a new God. You know what I'm saying? If that's the God that you have is one that you can like rip off, you know, like it can get stolen and no one knows where it went, it's time for a new God. And especially in light of how this ties into the other God that he just spoke to the night before in Gilead. This God of your fathers that is protecting and providing and staying my hand. Oh, and by the way, remember that other God that I had? Yeah, got stolen. So why'd you steal my gods? It's an astoundingly funny statement. And it gets even more funny. The comedy gets bigger after this. I don't know that we'll have time this morning. "Then Jacob replied to Laban, 'Because I was afraid, for I thought that you would take your daughters from me by force. The one with whom you find your God shall not live. In the presence of our kinsmen, point out what is yours among my belongings and take it for yourself.' For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them." So we're going to leave the story at this point, but I want you to recognize two very central points here, and this is where we're going to tie into next week. First off, Jacob is a deceiver. He's always been. But he's beginning to understand that his deception is not what is protecting him. It's God. He's beginning to see the real hand of God in his life. And he's beginning to recognize that as hard as he tries, sure, he can do all of these other things to make things better for himself, but at the end of the day, it's going to be God that provides and protects. And another thing is that he is a very much of a pansy. No offense, but he's a pansy. He ran from trouble. He ran from conflict. He ran from fighting. And he is now being forced into confrontation. He's being forced to stand and reckon and recognize that there's conflict that needs addressed, right? Two very significant things. And in light of this the next narrative becomes even more fantastic. I was going to start with the other one because that's really where we get into the whole next section, wrestling with God. But you see his character transform from here to there. And you've got to see both sides. That's the most important thing I want you to recognize. When you see an encounter with God, look for both sides. Look for the before and look for the after. Because that's when you really start to see the magnificence of your Savior. When you recognize that I was this. I was a coward. I was deceptive. I was manipulative. I was fearful. But now, I'm courageous and strong, and I believe God and take him at his word. You have to see the contrast. Otherwise, you're going to miss the power of God. You're going to miss an opportunity to see his magnificence displayed before you. All right? So that's where we're headed next week. But for now, let's go ahead and pray. God, thank you so much, Lord, for the opportunity that we have to examine the life of this deceiver. Lord, he's the grabber. He was named for his tendency, Lord, to, by his own wit and desire, accomplish his purposes. But Lord, you transformed him. Lord, you showed yourself to him face to face, and he was transformed. Lord, I pray that you'll help each of us to see the before and after. Give us a clear picture, Lord, a clear vision for the transformation that you are accomplishing in our lives. Lord, I pray that you'll help us to see it clearly. Lord, I want our group to constantly be enamored by and amazed by the change that comes as a result of our interaction with you. Lord, do magnificent things so that your name gets glory and so that we can see your hand clearly. Lord, we want to magnify you. We want to demonstrate and put on display that our God is powerful, that he cannot be stolen or contained, that he is so much greater than anything around us that others worship. Lord, I pray that you'll give us a heart for your glory. And it's in your name that we pray these things. Amen.